Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Raf Cormack's book, Midnight in Cairo, The Divas of Egypt's Roaring Twenties, tells the story of the lives of the women who were some of Egypt's biggest stars in the early 20th century. We are rerunning our conversation with Raf while we're on a break. And there are many other really wonderful older episodes that you can check out over the holidays, as well as our year-end episode, Best of 2021, that lists 10 books that we found remarkable in one way or another. And if you've enjoyed listening to us, there are a few things you can do to support the show. You can subscribe, rate us, share something about us on social media, or follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books, where we'll be sharing news about the upcoming season. Thank you and enjoy.
The next few years saw Rosal Youssef moving between various troops, picking up whichever job she could. One company she joined was led by the ambitious Okasha brothers, who were famous for both their flamboyance and theatrical success, if not always for their good acting. In her memoirs, Rose described the brothers' eccentricity, recalling that they did not believe in rehearsals, so the actors just learned their lines before the performance and hoped for the best. The company's star actress, Victoria Musa, had a problem with her throat that kept her from laughing with any volume. So, Rose claimed, another actress would stand behind the curtain and make laughing noises in the appropriate places. While part of that theatre company, she faced another attack, not from the audiences this time, but from the troupe's main source of funding. Again, the attack involved the clothes she wore, or didn't wear, and again, she emerged with her dignity intact. In her memoirs, written in the 1950s, Rose looked back at the event triumphantly. One summer day, she remembered, they were in Alexandria, doing a series of performances, and the troupe members were taking a break down by the sea. But when Rose got into her swimming costume and went down to where the Nile met the Mediterranean, she was in for a surprise. She did not know that the troupe's main financier, the conservative nationalist politician and banker Talat Harb, was also there by the water. A prominent figure in the early 20th century Egyptian politics and a supporter of the high arts, he is commemorated now with a statue that still stands at the centre of one of Cairo's busiest roundabouts. A financial backer that no theatrical company wanted to lose, Talat Harb was also a leading opponent of women's participation in the public sphere. So, when he saw a female member of his troupe exposing herself in a bathing suit in front of everyone, he demanded that she immediately cover up or be sacked and sent back to Cairo. A few of Rose's friends in the troupe tried to mediate. If she just apologized, they told her, they could smooth it over. But Rose, undaunted, said that she would not apologize. She had already faced criticism for, allegedly, wearing revealing clothing on stage, and she was not going to back down now. She said that she would rather leave the troupe on the spot so that she could spend the whole day on the beach. And she did exactly that, while the prudish banker looked on. In fact, after leaving the troupe, Rose stayed on a few extra days and sat on the beach in her swimming costume just to annoy him.
Hello, everyone. This is Ursula Lindsay, and this is episode 63 of the Bulak podcast. Reading to you just now was our guest today, Raf Cormack, who was reading a story about the great Egyptian actress and journalist Rosal Youssef from his book Midnight in Cairo, which we'll be discussing today. And Raf is joining us from Athens. I'm in Amman, Jordan, And Marsha, as usual, is in Rabat, Morocco.
Right, from where I have not budged, basically, for the last year.
Same here. Same here. No budging going on here either. And we've just surmounted quite a few technical difficulties, actually, in connecting the three of us. We all have a few challenges with background sounds and imperfect mics, but hopefully the sound will be good enough. And certainly I think the conversation is going to absolutely be worth it.
So I will start out by telling you that Raf Cormack got his PhD in Egyptian theater from the University of Edinburgh, and he's currently a visiting researcher at Columbia University, although he's actually in Athens. He was co-editor of Book of Khartoum, which was a collection of short stories that came out from Comma Press, and also edited the collection Book of Cairo, another collection of short stories from Comma Press, and has a translation in the new Book of Ramallah that is just out this month, I believe, from Comma Press. He was previously the practitioner of two blogs, Curiosities and Old Paper, but currently you can find him sharing things on Twitter, many stories from old Arabic newspapers about music, theater, crime, and other wonderful things. Thank you so much for joining us today, Raf.
Thanks so much for having me on.
We're so delighted to have you. I really enjoyed reading Midnight in Cairo, The Divas of Egypt's Roaring Twenties. There's so many wonderful anecdotes like the one you just read from. I wondered if you could start out by giving us sort of an overview of what's in the book, which, you know, it says 20s, but really there's, you know, there's stuff from the 1890s through the 1940s in there.
It's sort of, So what I think I was trying to do with this book, and as you said, I sort of developed recently a slight obsession with Cairo in the 20s and 30s, and I'm posting lots of stuff on it online. And it all started, I suppose, with my PhD, which was on sort of adaptations of Oedipus in 20th century Egypt, and therefore the Egyptian theater. And I just found all of these incredible stories which sort of tell of the world of Egyptian entertainment in the 20s and 30s. And so what I'm sort of trying to do with this is ask the question, basically, what it was like, what it would have been like to be in Egypt at that time. And in order to do that, I found that the sort of the most effective thing to do is tell it through the life stories of the women who lived through it, and, you know, the women who were actresses and singers and theater troupe leaders, cabaret owners, all of that kind of stuff. And I think it's a period which people are very interested in now in across the Middle East, you know, looking back at this time of the 20s and 30s. And it's both a fascinating and kind of hopeful period, but also one that we shouldn't look back with entirely rosy goggles on. And I think it helps, you know, looking through women's lives helps both see the potential, but also the kind of the many difficulties that there were in this much romanticized era.
Right. In even in the cases where women were very successful, that there were dark sides to that as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and what I try, like you say, I go back to the start of this entertainment business. So the focus is really kind of is geographical in a way. It's kind of the area of Esbekeia, you know, surrounding Ahmed Edin Street and Opera Square, and the various different sort of kinds of entertainment that were there, which really sort of get going in the late 19th century, although it did exist before then, and reached their kind of peak in the 20s and 30s. And so like you say, I mean, their stories, that story about Rose El-Youssef, which I just read, really, I think, captures some of the real opportunities that were becoming available to women in the period. And it's the women in this book who kind of show how they are putting themselves into the public sphere, kind of claiming their position in modern Egypt and a newly independent Egypt since the early 1920s, how they're both putting themselves into that and insisting that they should be there, but also the pushback that they have from people who are otherwise sort of great nationalist heroes.
Right. I don't know Talat Harb other than, you know, seeing his name on signs and stuff. So it was sort of startling and wonderful to find him as a real person.
Yeah.
I also think there's some other anecdotes about her that speak to what you're talking about some of the women that are featured in the book. I mean, they're so compelling. They're so interesting, but partly that's because they seem quite exceptional, or sort of at the forefront of certain changes that are taking place, and they assume that role for themselves, right, of being exceptional. Actresses and performers anyway have no lack of ego, but then a lot of these women have like really quite, you know, extraordinary lives. And I'm thinking about the exchanges that you quote with Rosa Yusuf, where people say, well, you're not like other women, or you're a man, like meant kind of as a compliment, or as a way of explaining how she can do what everybody else can't, and how she insists in those couple exchanges that you quote on saying, no, I'm a woman. Like, you don't have to call me a man to say that I can do these things, or that it's okay for me to do these things. You know, yeah, how she sort of insists on, no, I'm a woman and I do these things.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, like you say, it's because this generation of of entertainers is really a vanguard, or sees itself as a vanguard of women being in the public sphere. But also, I mean, and not just Rosal Yusuf, many of them really revel in the kind of transgressiveness of what they're doing in the 20s and 30s. I mean, I'm thinking of Munir al-Mahdiya as well, who in fact starts off her career in the early 20th century as a singer, and then becomes an actress in the 1910s, starts her own theatre troupe, but is very keen always to say that she is playing the male role in all of the plays. You know, she's the great Egyptian actress who's playing this male role. And I mean, Fatima Rushdie as well, another actress, is constantly being told that she's not really a woman because, she's too strong. She's too manly, even at one point, to play certain male roles. Sorry. But people like Munir al-Mahdiya as well caught it in the press. So she sends pictures of herself to the newspapers dressed up as a man. She holds these big poker parties on her houseboat in the Nile. There's this sense that she is part of a vanguard, and she's pricking the noses of anyone who wants to tell her that she can't do something because she's a woman. I mean, and she revels in it. And that's true of so many of these people, except perhaps Umm Kulthum, who has a very different way of constructing her celebrity.
Right. And I mean, and who is powerful and amazing in all her own ways. And I didn't know that she was, for instance, like a union boss at the time.
Umm Kulthum was, you obviously cannot ignore Umm Kulthum in telling this story, because she is the one person who really survived from the 1920s all the way, into the 70s as a huge star. And when I was first researching it, I in my head took a little bit against her, because I thought, oh, she's playing this quite conservative role, as opposed to the sort of more transgressive role of the other women. But I think it's unfair to say, to take against her. I think reading more into her life, it's just so impressive how she manages to form her career, take almost total control of it. Yeah, as you say, become like head of the musicians union, and really she puts across occasionally in the press, I mean, particularly in the 20s and 30s, a kind of meek persona, but it seems to be largely just a persona.
I mean, I think you can both be, of course, impressed both with, you know, her talent and her ability to manage herself and to be so successful and so powerful, and like take a little bit against her compared to some of the other figures of the era. I mean, because her will to power is a little terrifying. I've always felt that about Eun Kosum when you read about what she's like with her collaborators too. I mean, you know, there's stories about her like punishing people, like musicians and composers, because they had like written for another artist by like not speaking to them for decades and stuff. I mean, she's you know, extraordinary, but for good and bad. Like, you know what I mean? And she also has this, like, she kept herself so closed and so private. That's kind of what's fascinating about her. She made herself into an icon and like hid away so much of her true self. Like, you don't know, which reminds me a bit of Mahfouz. Like, Naki Mahfouz did something very similar, like kept his private life so private. And I feel like there's something about her becoming the icon, you know, this extreme and acceptable public icon was partly because she actually didn't share herself. Where some of the other figures in the book, you know, their whole, you know, a lot of their life gets, you know, spills out and like you say, they kind of embrace the chaos of their life and put it on a certain amount of display, or their freedom.
Yeah, and I suppose if you were being cynical, which maybe you don't have to be, you know, they're both kind of strategies of creating celebrity. I mean, Munir al-Mahdaya, who is the kind of the big rival to Eun Kosum, is a kind of polar opposite in that respect. You know, whereas Eun Kosum sort of, there's a great scene that comes just after the revolution, the Free Officers' Revolution, where Eun Kosum goes into the radio station and has herself filmed deleting old tapes, or, you know, deleting old bits of tapes, in which we assumed, you know, she references the king. I mean, it says in a newspaper article, Kowekib, I think it is, that she's, you know, deleting the bits of the old era. But that's such a good summary of what she kind of does with her career, which is kind of delete these little bits when it becomes necessary. Whereas Munir al-Mahdaya is sort of the total opposite, where she just adds these wild stories and sort of perhaps even spreads these rumors herself about her transgressiveness. I mean, both women have this same will to power that you're talking about with Eun Kosum. I think Munir al-Mahdaya has that as well.
Yeah.
Right. Well, she said, I mean, was it she who also was attempting to sabotage Eun Kosum's career in some ways?
Yeah. And which is, so the story is, as Eun Kosum is coming up in the late 20s, Munir al-Mahdaya is sort of planting stories against her in the press, and, you know, various other kinds of, the sense that I get is a lot of that stuff is also exaggerated later on. It becomes a sort of myth. There's these stories about Munir al-Mahdaya casting spells on Eun Kosum, which, I mean, there's also
right,
a bit of misogyny.
It was also par for the course, right? These kinds of stories, like, because then Eun Kosum is supposed to have like assassinated Asmahan or something, basically, or like, you know, there were those kinds of stories that supposedly they were all, you know, and like you say, I think this was speculation in the press. Though, of course, there were real rivalries, like professional rivalries. But the other thing that comes through so clearly is how important the press was. Like, is this ecosystem of the performing arts and the press, including kind of like a society gossip press, and the interest of the public, not just in the performances, but in the performers' lives.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And how you kind of play the press really changes how you're written into the historical record. So there are various people who sort of briefly mentioned in the book, but whose stories kind of don't survive anymore because the press simply kind of didn't take an interest. I mean, I think that's something that people who have written on Naima al-Masraya say, that partly she is not remembered. Another singer, Naima al-Masraya, like a very big singer of the 20s and 30s, but who didn't really feature that much in the press or write a memoir, so isn't remembered in the same way that the others are. Which is not to say the press always has to like you. I mean, someone like Yusuf Wahbi, the actor, was hated by almost all the press, it seems. but they kept writing stories about him because they were annoyed by him so much.
But they didn't cover his big South America tour, which I found disappointing.
Yeah, even though he sent them articles.
I know. I was offended on his behalf as I read that.
Were you always decided to, from the beginning, more interested in telling the story of the female performers and singers and actresses? Or is that something that evolved over time? Or because I suppose there are male figures in this scene but the book does kind of focus on the women of this time and this place.
Yeah, and there are, a lot of important male figures who are covered, but I got the sense, I mean, to be very honest, what I really got me into this was the idea that maybe you could tell write a biography of Munir al-Mahdaya. It just didn't quite seem possible. I didn't have all the material. And then other people suggested that maybe building up around the scene, the whole building up a whole world around it would be a better way to go. And then I think if you're going to build a whole world, as I think I said before, that I think women's stories are just really the best lens to look at it through because they really carry with them this sense, which I think is so important in the 1920s, of new possibilities, but also the various downsides. And, you know, I don't shy away from telling some of the, you know, a lot in fact of the stories where women are exploited. I mean, you get some great women who rise up and really manage to sort of use the scene to their advantage, you know, open up, make money, open up their own businesses and, you know, make their voices heard. But you also get the stories of people who are chewed up and kind of spat out by this world. So the most famous one is probably Imtiazel Fawzi, who is a sort of up and coming dancer, actress, singer in the 1930s, and she appears briefly in a movie, and then decides in 1936 to open up her own cabaret along with a partner, and she comes across the local group of sort of heavies who control Esmeralda, and they demand some protection money, which either she can't afford or she doesn't want to give. Either way, she doesn't pay them, and they start threatening her. She goes to the police, but is ignored, and eventually they kill her on stage, or just after she comes off stage in a performance. When telling this story of the 20s and 30s in general, I think it's important to balance a kind of nostalgia, which I don't object to, actually. I think it's good to look back at a period and see what you can get from it, see what positive things you can bring, but also with a sense of reality too, that this was not a utopia.
Right. It was also a time of tremendous changes. And I think, to me, some of the women were more successful at navigating the technological changes from records to radio, suddenly film is a major thing than other women who sometimes seem defeated by the shift to film, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and also, I don't think it's this, the period of this history is exclusively told through men. I think that's not true. I think the women have been represented in history, but I think the greats of this period are usually remembered as, you know, the men, the Muhammad Abdul Wahhabs, the Yusuf Wahbis, George Abiyadi, Saad Darwish, who all kind of are greats, but they're, you know, the pantheon of the greats of Egyptian entertainment culture doesn't feature women as quite as prominently as it should. I mean, so you mentioned film. A lot of the great early film directors were women. I mean, Aziz Amir, Fatima Rushdie made some films, Bahiga Hafiz, all that. And then, and I'm not saying they've been totally ignored, but they, I don't get the sense that they're centered quite as much as they could be or should be.
Right. And another thing I was curious about, so many of these women's lives end badly in one way or another. I think, you know, the murder was a bit singular, but, you know, other women like Munira die in poverty, being forgotten, their career having sort of skid out. Was that also true of men, or is that something that's one can more associate with women entertainers?
My sense is that the narrative of a strong, powerful woman who's kind of a little bit transgressive, ending her life alone, as it were, is a kind of story that's only really ever told about women in that tragic way. I mean, not, you know, globally speaking. I think if a man dies alone, as it were, it's kind of not even necessarily seen as a tragedy in the way that it is as when a woman dies alone. I don't know if you agree with that.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I guess I can't point to any. I guess I would. Yeah, it's true. If a man was very powerful and very famous, and then later in life he retired and wasn't, I wouldn't feel that it was a terrible thing. No. But yes, with Munira, I felt sad about her.
Well, and I think what Raf is saying is that you're meant to feel sadder about it, maybe, than about a man. That somehow the fact that she's lost her physical appeal, or that she doesn't have a family, that's like more of a tragedy, like than in the case of a man. Or I don't know how many stories they did where they went and found old actors or performers and showed their fall from grace. I mean up to this day, female performers, there's more of an interest in their fall from grace.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And it's, and I found when writing the book, it's a very kind of hard way of telling a story to get away from. I mean everyone dies, kind of. No one's life ends happily. I mean, everyone ends by death.
Right. Yeah, although Um Kulsum ends right at the peak of the mountain.
Right. I mean, the other thing is, the book is very much about this particular place in Cairo, which I mean, we know and sort of don't know. Like, I kept trying to picture the way it was. And again, as Marcia says, there's been so much like incredible change and violent change, including on the level of the built environment in Cairo in the 20th century, that like a lot of the buildings and establishments that you mentioned aren't there anymore. And the whole atmosphere of the neighborhood has also changed tremendously. Like, it's just been gone through so many evolutions, but of course it is there. It is in downtown Cairo. Like, you know, as Bikinig.
You know, as writing the book, I did a number of walks kind of through the area where places were to see what still survives. And there were two really, in my view, sort of two different areas to Ezbekeia. There was the Emedidine Street area, which was quite, you know, a wide street with nice newly built cabarets and kind of very plush and expensive. And then there was the area more to the east of the gardens, which is, you know, like Clot Bay Street and Wischelberke and all of that area, which had, which was a little more sort of clubs down side alleys and that kind of thing. In that area to the east, I mean, it seems to have totally changed, but a lot of the shells of the buildings do still survive. So the old Arabic theater, what it was called, Al-Masri al-Arabi, I think, or Al-Masri, I forget his name now, but on the top of Abdulaziz Street, turned into a cinema, but then the cinema closed down, but the shell of the building is still there, sort of filled with old washing machines. And the Alhambra Casino, which was Naim al-Masraya's casino, then turned into Suad Mohsen's, the shell of that building is also still there, so I think it's a mechanic. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the environment has grown around it. Whereas on Emededdin Street, you can really see sort of a little bit what it had been like. A lot of the buildings have now been knocked down and turned into newer cinemas. The Diana Palace is the one, I think it was built in the 40s, still survives. And the Scheherazade Casino, which have you guys, I don't know if you guys have been to, but I mean, Metamask used to have.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the interior has probably changed quite a lot, but that was the old, started as the Printania Theater, then turned into the Palotta Court, which is another strange thing I had no idea about in Cairo's nightlife, that the Basque game of Palotta was so popular.
Yeah, me neither. And the games would start at midnight. That's something that hasn't changed. Like you quote it at one point, some impresario who's complaining about these Egyptian musicians, like, I can't get them to start work before midnight or go to bed before dawn. And that is how the art sector, I feel like, still functions in Egypt today. Like, people were always making movies in the middle of the night and stuff. So your title of your book is perfect.
Yeah. But yeah, I suppose to go back to what we were talking about, the... there is a sense that everything has sort of moved out of Emededdin Street in Ezbekeia, and it's a similar narrative arc to, you know, the stories of women's lives which end in dying alone or what have you. That, you know, it's the Weimar Berlin arc, as you might call it, the great nightclub, whatever, nightclub scenes always end in this decline, which is both true, but probably obscures some of the complexities.
Right, of nightclubs moving elsewhere and just being different in different time periods. It's not as if there's no nightlife anymore.
I know that. I mean, you go to what was Ezbekeia, you can find lots of, you know, quite seedy nightclub bars, but I imagine in the 1920s, a lot of the bars were quite seedy then as well.
Well, what do you think is the, you said that there's a fascination with this time and place, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I have some thoughts, but what do you think is the source or what is it that plays into this, you know, just ongoing interest with this scene?
I think at the basis of all of it is this idea that this was a time when new things were possible and there was a chance for kind of change. The 20s and 30s in Egypt, when, you know, it had just become independent and people were really talking about what the new Egypt could be. And lots of people were disagreeing. And, you know, there was a sense that women were now part of the conversation. There's also, I mean, people are very interested in the cosmopolitanness of it all. There's a kind of nostalgia about that. I mean, people look back at it and look at today and see very little hope and see kind of, I think a lot of people see a society that's closed off to the kind of cosmopolitanism which was there in the 1920s and 30s. And partly, you know, one's job as a historian is to say, on the one hand, actually the 1920s and 30s wasn't great. There was this so-called cosmopolitanism, but arguably it was very exploitative and most of the people in the country could not be part of that. But also to say, you know, I don't want to stop people looking back at history and saying, here's a time when things could be different, and taking some real messages from that time.
Well, and there's one of the things I really liked was the the way the art being performed itself was so hybrid, like that they're rewriting European plays for a local audience and like changing them, and for example adding music because that was required, like and this Franco-Arab review, this idea of a kind of mix of genres, some of them coming from like, you know, a traditional almost skit-based comic traditions that were local, and then like, you know, French vaudeville, like all of that is very appealing to me, you know, this kind of creativity and mixity in on that level.
Yeah, and also, yeah, I suppose allowing the history of Egyptian entertainment to be part of that cosmopolitan Egypt. We could devote a whole podcast to the idea of cosmopolitan Egypt, but just to be able to say, no, this wasn't necessary. Cosmopolitanism isn't just Europeans in their sort of closed off areas, not interacting right. with Egyptians. There's an alternative, you know, a counter history to it, in which Egyptians were part of whatever we want to call cosmopolitanism, multiculturalism, or something.
Yeah, I was also, really taken by how much these acts moved around, not just to Palestine and spending time in Beirut and taking the very dangerous trip, apparently, to Baghdad, but also traveling to South America to do shows there, which apparently we hear were very successful. And then also North American, particularly it seemed in the book, African-American performers coming to Cairo to be part of that scene as well.
Yeah, and I mean, so when I post things on Twitter, as we talked about, I sort of have an account where I just post random things which I've seen, which are fun. And sometimes people like them, and sometimes people kind of are okay, but they mostly ignore them. The things that people really seem to be interested in are, you know, A, stars like Umm Kulsum, she always does well. Fatima Rushdie, but also this idea that in the 20s and 30s there was this transnational world where people could go from, you know, take the train from Cairo to Jerusalem to Beirut and then go on to Baghdad or, you know, across North Africa or even go on tour to South America, that people, in my experience, are very interested by this idea that there was so much movement at the time.
But there was not movement. So I saw in the book that there were stories, particularly sources from, say, the Chicago Defender, of musicians coming from the U.S. to Cairo. But I didn't see them traveling to perform in North America.
Yeah, there's as far as I could work out, none of the people who are really seriously featured in the book did that. But the violinist Sami Alshoa, who probably gets mentioned, but I mean only briefly, who was probably the biggest violin player in the 20s and 30s. He did go on a North American tour. A lot of Egyptian films get shown in North America as well. I mean, there's a big Arab community in New York, supposedly, in the 20s and 30s. And so the films do travel, and there's an archive in Albany in New York of all the films that were shown. They had to submit their scripts to censorship. But it doesn't seem as big as South America, which was a much more popular touring destination for traveling Arab troops.
Because the audiences were better, or
my sense is probably that maybe the trip was easier. I'm not sure, but they had guarantees of audience in more places. Perhaps if you go to North America, you have like New York, Boston, but maybe that's about all you can do. Whereas in South America, you can travel around. I mean, I don't know. That's speculation.
I'm sure they were looking. It was the business decision first and foremost, right? The tours. It seems like. I mean, the other thing I think that comes through about how this history is viewed is just like so much ambivalence over, I mean, I like also how in the neighborhood, like you say, there's the high-end theaters and, you know, the more seedy clubs, and they're all close to each other. Like you go from high to quote unquote low art in a short walk, right? I mean, it's all mixed and the performers themselves move from one to the other. And then you see in the way it's sort of perceived and talked about, the sort of mix of feelings where there's kind of waves of sort of cracking down on the morals of the area or of the shows. I didn't know that belly dancing was ever made illegal in Egypt. Like, I really didn't know that. You know,
it's a strange way that the belly dancing being made illegal, that it's, I mean, at least according to one story, that it's, you know, it's specifically this thing called, but because it's a kind of belly dancing which has sort of been developed in the West and then kind of re-imported it. It's this sort of wild story of you know, Arabic dancers, Egyptian dancers, going to, say, the 1893 World Exhibition in Chicago, and everyone being amazed by this, by their style of dance, and then in America and Europe, sort of developing danse du ventre or belly dance, which is sort of somehow related to more traditional Arabic dances, but a pastiche of, then that becoming very popular and then sort of coming back into Egypt, but being banned. So it's not all dances that are banned, but very specifically Roxo Button.
Right. But, and also then you get into this question of, like, you know, judges and policemen sort of determining what dance is to be banned, you know, like they'll know it when they see it of the dances. I mean, and then of course at some point that must have ended because then there was in Egyptian cinema, like there's often like a dance is featured, right? There's usually often a scene and in which there's singing and this kind of like very, I'm sure not very traditional, like cinematic kind of belly dancing that's clearly, you know, in the outfits and everything, like has had a lot of innovations.
Yeah. But I mean, to get back to your broader point about sort of the idea of it's sort of amoral or, you know, improving theater and low and high. Yeah, it's so difficult to really actually separate any of it. So, I mean, you have, I mean, going on dance and singing and theater, but really they're all totally overlapping. And the people who are dancers are later appearing in the theater or singing. But at the back of everyone's head, there is this kind of hierarchy of high theater and sort of low dancing. And also added to that, that the red light district was very close to that.
And but also high and low audiences, right? I mean, sometimes you could put on a performance that you felt was quite highbrow entertainment, but you know, if you were doing it in front of a drunken audience that's shouting things at you, it's not
that heckled you.
Yeah.
But then, and then you have, you know, Yusuf Wahbi's troupe are very keen to, which the Ramses troupe, which becomes the sort of most well-financed and probably most successful acting troupe, I mean, except perhaps Fatima Rushdie's in the 20s and 30s. And they're obsessed with policing both the audience and the content of the plays that you put on, which are sort of these melodramatic sort of stories in which everyone gets killed or falls in love and has an affair or whatever. So it's not kind of what we would class necessarily high theater, but he's obsessed, has all these rules for what the audience can do and what they can't do, because he wants to, when everything is so close together, you have to build these kind of more imaginary walls.
Well, I sympathize. I mean, you don't want people's cell phones going off. You don't want drunken patrons jumping on the stage. Really?
But doesn't a really small part of you, though, because because I've never been, I mean, doesn't a very small part of you find it like somewhat appealing to at least witness like an audience that is that unruly and sort of like that, you know, not necessarily like disrespectful to the performers, but that has not been sort of coached into the like respectful silence, you know, of kind of modern audience behavior. Like, I don't know. I think there's always something I find a little bit appealing too about, you know, the idea of people just reacting very spontaneously to what's on stage.
And it's something in the 60s and 70s that a lot of Arab playwrights try and sort of recapture, not necessarily unruly, but this idea of interacting with audiences.
Right, like Sadeh Lavrahous's...
Exactly.
Right.
Or Yusuf Idris as well.
Or even the singers, apparently, like they counted on the audience reacting so much, right? That's an anecdote where Munir al-Mahdiya is thrown off by performing in front of an empty, because she needs the like exclamations of the audience and stuff.
Yes, right.
It was such a symbiotic relationship. When you listen, when you look at Umm Kulsum concerts, like you, those audience shots where people are like, you know, biting their handkerchiefs and like near fainting, like it's, they're feeding each other, right? The audience and the performer.
Yeah, totally.
So one thing I wanted to ask about was all these, the memoirs that you talk about reading and talk about the stars writing. I wondered if this was a sort of a later phenomenon, if there was a particular decade when suddenly we were flooded with stars memoirs, or if they were coming out all along.
It's, I mean, the answer, short answer is the 1960s is when things really sort of seem to get going, maybe like a little bit late 50s. So I suppose what you would call after the kind of end of the particular golden age of cabaret and acting, and maybe more into a different kind of theatre and film, is when really a lot of the memoirs start to come up. 1960s is, so Fatima Rushdie in that decade publishes four separate memoirs, all sort of covering slightly different aspects of her career in different ways, but telling a few of the same stories. And Badia Masabni's memoirs come out, I think, probably early 70s. The I mean, the appearance of Al Masra magazine, the 1960s one, leads to a kind of flood of memoirs because they serialize a lot of them. And more of these magazines, like Kawakib, also serializes some memoirs of Naguiba Rahani. I think that comes in the 40s, actually, so I might be putting my point off. But yeah, Yusuf Wahbi's memoirs also come out at the same time. There is a big time when all the memoirs come out, I suppose, when people's careers start to, you know, come to an end and they're looking back at them. And there's so many, I mean, almost all the women who are covered in this book left some kind of autobiographical writing, and almost all of them left memoirs like this. Munir al-Mahdiya never did, although in the 20s, some selections of things which are called her memoirs are published in Al Masra magazine. They're sort of referenced to having seen them, but they're, I suppose they're lost, we'd call it. They're really fascinating documents, sort of literary and historical documents, of the way that these people constructed their careers and, you know, retold their careers. Probably the most famous one is Yusuf Wahbi's, because it's so gossipy and sort of egotistical slightly.
Sounds great.
And yeah, it's a really fun read, and it's an actor's memoir, so it's exactly what you would expect a kind of dramatic actor's memoir to be like. You know, I was the greatest at this point, and everyone says I'm not, you know, but they're all there, and yeah, to see how people construct their careers is interesting. The women's careers and memoirs, one thing I found very interesting about them was that they barely ever mention any kind of female solidarity, basically. They don't really mention the actress friends that they might have had, or the friends who were singers. It's all about constructing themselves as this kind of, as we were saying before, as this sort of leader of a vanguard of new women coming through in the 20s and 30s. So, I mean, for instance, Fatima Rushdie, who wrote these four different memoirs, basically never mentions the fact that she had three sisters who are also all performers.
There's also, they don't talk a lot about their origins often, it sounds like. Like a lot of your stories, say, sort of have to pick up those women's biographies as they enter the stage because there's very little or sort of conflicting information about their early lives and they don't seem to go into that much, I guess.
Yeah, or sometimes I'll sort of have a quite seemingly mythologized version of the story. Yeah, but early lives of all these women are subject to a lot of controversy. I mean, I think partly because a lot of these women had extremely tough early lives and didn't necessarily want to talk about them. I mean, we mentioned Umm Kulthum being sort of standing apart from a lot of these women. One way in which she did is she's, I think, the only one whose father didn't die when she was a child. I think all of the women, their fathers died, and you can see how maybe, you know, that is a gateway into having to make money and therefore being shoved onto the stage, perhaps, you know, against their will. And they largely came from poverty, largely uneducated. I mean, that's one of the things that is quite amazing about all of these stories. They were almost exclusively poor, uneducated women who really managed to make something of themselves. And that's one thing which can be said, at least for the entertainment industry, is that it managed to give at least this small section of women that opportunity.
I really loved how many of them managed to take control of their stories and, say, blot out things or create confusion about parts of their lives that they didn't want talked about. You know, contemporary world, it seems like there's so many things revealed about you that you might prefer not to be revealed, but that they managed to take control of their own narrative in you know, to certain degrees, of course, you know, the press also being able to shape narratives as well.
Yeah, and it's a constant battle with the press, being, you know, exactly, but a battle that quite often they win, not always. But.
And so you read all these biographies, and clearly you also immersed yourself in the archives of the press from the time. Were those your main sources for the book? What was your process like? Were you?
Yeah, I mean, those are really the two main sources. So all those memoirs and the press, which there's an enormous amount of magazines that were started up on and off. I mean, Rosa Yusuf, El Masra, Sabah, big ones, but there's, you know, lots of them that ran for sort of a year and then folded. And in National Library of Egypt and other places, they exist and they're always in competition with each other, and they're full of stories. And they're the two main sources. Squaring those two sources is sometimes difficult. And often, you know, I've just in the book said, oh, well, this is what the memoir says, this is what the press said at the time, you decide, kind of thing. There's also, I mean, there's been some really great academic work done in Arabic on this stuff, which I use. I mean, Ratiba Hipni did a very good book on Munira Mahdia. At the end, so they tend not to like footnotes in sort of trade publications, but obviously having come up through academia, I'm obsessed with footnotes. So I decided to meet them halfway and just leave a kind of a bit at the end of further reading, which goes into that. There's a slight difficulty in some of the stuff that's written later, is that some of it is over mythologized and some stories are sort of told without much evidence. I mean, that's clearest in the case of Shafi'a al-Ibtiyya, who is the first a woman from the 1890s, who was the great music hall owner of the 1890s. In the 60s, a film and a book and a play about her were published, which have some amazing stories in, but also have some things which sort of couldn't possibly have happened. She was said to have, you know, met Sir Darwish in 1924 or something, a year after he died. I can't remember what, there's some obvious historical inaccuracies in them. So, and that's the thing that I've sort of, that anything dealing with this period has to come up against, how far you go into mythologization and how far you're a stickler for exactly what happened, which is probably sometimes impossible to say.
Sure. I mean, so some of the stories must have happened quite in view of the press, like the whole the singer, the baby in the bay chapter.
But even that, I mean, which is a story of Fatma Siri, who had an affair with Huda Sharawi's son, and then there was a child which he denied paternity of. Eventually she goes into the law courts and fights for sort of 6 or 7 years and manages to win the right of paternity, which was extremely well covered in the press, and one magazine serialized a kind of 16-part account of the story from Fatma Siri's perspective. But still, we don't really have the Sharawi family's perspective on it.
Right, yeah, we don't know exactly what Hoda's role was in it.
Which in a way is the most fascinating. I mean, there's a very fascinating element to that, is that you have the singer pitted against possibly a feminist icon whose son has not been raised to treat women that well, it turns out. I mean, there's so much there, right? There's so much narrative potential there, so much that you want to know. And then I was going to ask you, with a lot of the recordings and the movies, sometimes with the movies you say that there's no, that they haven't survived. So all you have is descriptions of the films. How hard was it to find, you know, I mean, someone like Munir al-Mahdiya, obviously there are recordings and other famous artists, but were there ones where it was very hard to sort of see what their work had been, or where not much survived?
Yeah, I mean, so one example of that, if from the 1920s, that's generally pretty good. I mean, I'm sure you guys do, you can look on YouTube and a lot of songs are there, but there's also the Amar Foundation in Lebanon, who are really doing a great job of digitizing and putting online lots of old 78s. But there's the case of Shafi'a al-Ibtiyya, who did record some songs, and they're available in, they exist in the National Library of Egypt, but when I went, they had not yet been digitized, and you can only go to the National Library of Egypt. You can't get out 78 and put it on a record. You have to listen to what's been digitized. And as far as I'm aware, they're the only recordings of her songs that I'm aware of existing. I mean, I'm sure somewhere else they do. So I haven't been able to listen to any of them, which is annoying, obviously. But a lot of the songs in the 20s and 30s you can get to.
Online. We'll put some links in the show notes to some of these sources, I think. Because, of course, after reading about these women, one becomes very curious to hear their voices, to see what you can of their work. Yeah,
I think that I've become very attached to most of them.
And I mean, the other thing that is interesting to talk about is the literature of the period, which I would love to be able to put together a kind of compilation of short stories about Cairo's nightlife district, or entertainment industry from the 20s and 30s. because not a huge amount exist, but some do. Short story writers, there's Mahmoud Kamil. I cited he writes a story about sort of a love affair with a dancer. And in old Egyptian magazines, there's lots of, not lots, but a number of short stories about actors. There are even, which I haven't been able to find, cases of singers and actresses writing their own short stories, which I've seen references to, but I've not been able to actually find. They would be great to find.
Yeah, I mean, when I looked in the, you know, for the crime issue of Arabic Lit Quarterly and looked in the crime magazines, there were just actually thousands of these largely unauthored, you know, with no anonymously written, you know, short stories about crime.
And that are set in this, in partly in the sort of nightlife setting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there's in Midak Ali, in Naguib Mahfouz's novel, there's the whole storyline of the sort of ambitious, sensual young woman who ends up sort of taking a lover, but then falling into prostitution. And it's, I'm pretty sure it's in, when her old boyfriend from the neighborhood finally runs into her, it's in this district, it's in Esbekeya, and she's at a bar with a bunch of foreign soldiers, which was also this big element, right? That the British and Australian soldiers would go out there for fun and cause all sorts of trouble, and this was also a big part of some of the criticism and the concern about moral issues.
And the British blamed the Egyptians, of course.
for being immoral, you know, luring their soldiers who would otherwise have been very upright young men.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's clearly, and of course, in the Mahfouz novel, it being Mahfouz, like, it's not, even though there is a clear sort of nationalist, you know, I would, you know, message to the book, it's always a bit more nuanced or interesting than just that. So, you know, her and I think his depiction overall of nightlife in Cairo is not just a sort of moralistic one, but in this instance there is clearly this nationalist concern. The other thing that surprised me a bit in the book, and I don't, maybe I shouldn't have been, was how political a lot of the singers and actresses were. I guess I assumed, and maybe that's condescending on my part, that they would be, you know, busy with their work and their business and not want to stick their neck out. And on the contrary, like, they got into all sorts of trouble supporting, you know, mostly the nationalist cause.
Yeah, I mean, Taher Carioca is the most outstanding example of that, who literally joined a leper organization and was sent to prison for it for some months. I mean, you know.
Mm.
But yeah, so many of them did, and Munira Mahden, her songs, and Fatima Rushdie put on this version of Julius Caesar, which was seen to be critical of the government and was then censored. They're all sort of testing these political lines at a time when women are excluded from formal politics.
Right. Yeah, no, they were risk takers. It's fascinating. Well, maybe we will wrap it up here. I mean, there's a million more stories to tell, but people should, you know, turn to the book for that.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much for talking.
Thank you so much for joining us. And so we're going to put some links to sources and archives if we can in the show notes. And we're going to end with a bit of the music of Munir al-Mahdeya.
Thanks again for listening, and thank you, Raf, for being with us.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much.
بالمعنى ده الساوي Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.